Ultras behind us now. Archives on the LP. Dark Entries, reissue of 1984 cassette. Track we're hearing now called Rise. Yoga prior to that. New LP is called Skinwalker. We heard Amin and Anakim. Yoga preceded by The Pyramids. Great 18-minute track called Nsarama. Parenthetically, The Stars from King of Kings. And that's everything we heard, my friends, my very good friends. Happy to be with you today on Freeform Radio, WFMU, in East Orange, WMFU, Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Look forward to seeing you next week. This is Scott saying goodnight. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is coming right up. We'll be right back.
Just after 6 o'clock, and you are listening to WFMU Freeform Radio. My name's Benjamin Walker, doing an hour of freeform podcasts. That's right. Well, yours truly recovers from his nervous breakdown, putting together some new programs, taking a couple weeks, and playing some other spoken word podcast related audio that I'm quite fond of and happy to share with you. And playing in the background here a track, I think I heard it a few weeks ago on Liz Berg's show from Monroeville Music Center on the WFMU Free Music Archive. But I think we'll start off today with part two of that amazing Johnny Cash and Prison Reform documentary that we listened to part one of last week. This is from the BBC World Service, and they're very forward-thinking in that all of their shows go into their documentary podcast feed. So we heard part one last week that talked about some of the other prison concerts that Johnny Cash did. And this week, on part two, we're going to hear about his obsession with Sweden as well, here on WFMU.
On October the 3rd, 1972, Johnny Cash walked out on stage to perform in front of a group of prisoners. Cash's live albums, recorded at Folsom Prison and San Quentin, had sold millions just a few years earlier. But there was something different about this prison performance. When the man in black opened his mouth, he spoke...
Tack mina vänner.
...in Swedish.
Jag hoppas att ni tycker om vår musik.
For the first and only time in his career, Johnny Cash played for prisoners outside America at an inconspicuous prison called Österåker, just outside Stockholm. I'm Danny Robbins. And in this BBC World Service series, I'm exploring a lesser-known side to Johnny Cash, discovering what turned a famous country and western star into a passionate prison reformer.
Österåker, you've been living hell to me.
I'll be finding out what motivated Cash to travel halfway across the world to play in a small Swedish prison, and how Cash did more than just perform for prisoners. He actually took one into his home.
Well, my daddy left home when I was three, didn't leave very much to my ma and me, except this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze.
Cash had been performing unpaid concerts for prisoners since the late 1950s.
Was before he left, he wouldn't name me Sue. Well, he must have thought...
But following the huge success of his live prison albums, he found himself the high-profile spokesman for a growing civil rights movement, wishing to reform America's inhumane and ineffective penal system.
On a Monday, I was arrested. On a Tuesday, they locked me in the jail. Oh, boy.
Cash biographer Michael Streisgood.
The 1960s was an era of protest music, of highly charged political music. And, of course, he was interested in the experience of prison inmates.
I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders, and them chains, they're about to drag me down.
I think the difference was he went into these prisons and, I think, communicated an element of hope to them, all the while really exposing and communicating to vast audiences what prison conditions were like.
On a Thursday, I start on bread and water for a while. I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders. I got chains, chained around my feet. I got stripes.
He actually went to the White House and visited with President Nixon in the early 1970s to make clear that he believed that reform needed to happen in prisons across America. He appeared before the United States Senate. There's really little question that Johnny Cash was the most prominent person ever to lobby the U.S. Senate on the question of prison reform.
The transcript of Cash's 1972 Senate appearance still exists.
Statement of Johnny Cash, Hendersonville, Tennessee. I have seen and heard of things at some of the concerts that would chill the blood of the average citizen.
Tommy Cash is Johnny's youngest brother. He had never seen or heard Johnny's testimony until I asked him to read some of it at his Nashville home.
At a southern prison where I performed, a 15-year-old boy was in prison for car theft and was raped continually all night long by his fellow inmates, and he died the next morning. In another prison, a teenager was imprisoned and his clothes were taken away from him to shame him for his crime. He hanged himself.
Jacob Green got busted for possession.
In his evidence, Johnny outlined in powerful and detailed terms what he thought was wrong with the system and how it could be changed.
At the jail, they took away his clothes to shame him and to make sure Jacob Green had no pride left. They cut off all his hair. Today they found him hanging there, afraid to face the day he killed himself.
Did you know that he felt about it that strongly?
No.
There's an anger behind this, that he can't believe that the system is like this and he wants to change it.
Well, he was deeply involved in it. I can see that the paperwork you're showing me today is unbelievable.
Not only Jacob Green, but many more you've never seen.
How does it make you feel seeing that now? This is what your brother said at the Senate.
It's exciting. It's very exciting. And I'm not surprised that my brother was this strongly involved in this. And I'm so glad to see it after all these years.
Cash wasn't alone giving evidence that day. Standing alongside him, dressed awkwardly in a suit and tie, was a recently released ex-convict named Glenn Shirley, who Cash had first met 4 years earlier when he recorded his concert at Folsom Prison.
Glenn Shirley was a chronic criminal. He found himself in Folsom Prison after a string of bank robberies. Shirley, though, in prison, tinkered around with songwriting. And he knew the Reverend Gressett, who was the chaplain at the prison. And Gressett had seen his talent and offered to take some of his lyrics to Johnny Cash.
Thank you very much. This next song was written by a man right here in Folsom Prison. And last night was the first time I've ever sung this song.
This is anyway, where Cash the Showman steps forward.
This song was written by our friend Glenn Shirley.
And Cash knows the powerful value of actually recording and performing a song written by an inmate at Folsom.
There's a gray stone chapel here at Folsom. A house of worship in this den of sin.
While I was in Nashville, I visited Glenn's daughter, Rhonda Shirley.
What happened after he met Johnny that first time? How did his life change?
He moved from a maximum security prison to a minimum security prison. He did his own album from prison that had never been done in California. I don't know that it had ever been done anywhere in the United States that an inmate had recorded a live album from prison.
This next song I'm going to do for you here might sound a little cold-blooded, I guess. But if you've been here, you'll know what I'm talking about, because you've seen it just like I have. If you just got here, well, God help you, man, because you've still got this side of ugly to see. And when I say ugly, that's just what I mean. Ugly.
He thought that people could come out of prison and could make a life for themselves. I think he felt by choosing the right song or the right words that he could affect people's lives.
If this prison yard could talk.
Thanks to Johnny's intervention, Glenn Shirley was granted parole. But Cash didn't leave it there. He invited Shirley to stay at his house, gave him a songwriting deal, and was even best man at his wedding.
A strong man's blood runs cold. Now it seems some with too much time to do.
Cash thought that his message about prison reform would be much more potent if people knew that he himself was working to rehabilitate prisoners.
Struck down by another man.
He would say in interviews with people, in conversations with politicians, that the people need to show that they care about the inmates. The inmates need to have some idea that people on the outside care about them.
It'd be a story to chill the soul.
Glenn Shirley's example was a living, breathing payoff to Cash's crusade.
Cash's belief in rehabilitation over punishment might have seemed radical in the States, but across the Atlantic in Scandinavia, this view was commonplace. By the early 70s, Sweden's prison system had a reputation for being one of the most progressive in the world. Cash had never performed in a prison outside America, but this was about to change. I travelled to the Swedish capital, Stockholm. Cash arrived here to play a unique concert in October 1972, just a few months after his Senate appearance. I arranged to meet Börje Lundberg, a Swedish music journalist who could tell me more.
Börje, you were working for the Expressen newspaper in 1972.
Yes, I did.
And how much was known by the press at that time about this concert?
Well, the thing was that it was a very famous Swedish lawyer called Olof Arvidsson. He met Johnny and his manager in the States, and he came up with the idea to Johnny Cash to sing in a Swedish prison. He had read about Swedish prison and was informed by Arvidsson about that people were supposed to be reformed in Swedish prisons. They would come out better people than when they were put in jail. And he liked that. He liked the human touch of the Swedish prison system. It's more human than the American system where you just lock people up. The proof is he came here and sang.
The place selected for Cash's appearance was Österåker, a new facility a few kilometres north of Stockholm. If Swedish prisons had a reputation for being liberal, then even by their standards, Österåker was groundbreaking. Karl-Åke Farbring was a prison therapist there at the time Cash visited.
I was very lucky to work at Österåker because at that time it was a very liberal atmosphere and we had lots of resources. I mean, we had about two staff on every prisoner. Can you imagine? Two staff on every prisoner. The prisoners had civilian clothes. People who came from outside couldn't say which one is a prisoner and which one is staff here. So at that time, extremely progressive.
The liberal regime of Österåker seemed to represent everything Cash had been campaigning for. As I drove north through picturesque pine forests, Österåker appeared ahead of me. Initially, it didn't look that much like a prison.
The walls are quite pink. I expected kind of intimidating grey walls, but they are quite pink.
Inside, there were more examples of Österåker's alternative approach. I was shown one of the rooms where inmates are allowed to have their families to stay.
We've been asked to be quiet so we don't disturb the prisoners. It feels so strange to hear a baby in prison. Uh-huh.
Cash had decided that the concert should be recorded. The man in charge of making this happen was Klas Berling, the Swedish representative of CBS Records.
We're looking out the window, we see the prison walls from the inside and the big doors and the van.
Klas met me at the prison, the first time he'd been back in 40 years.
They had to pull the cables in through this ventilation shaft under the window and into the congregation hall. That was considered a very high risk at the time.
Should we go into the room where it all happened?
This is
it.
Oh, wow.
It's possible.
This is the historic place.
Inside was a small hall, a world away from the big venues Cash normally played.
I was not able to sit in the audience to watch the performance because we were not supposed to mix. So I stood at the back of the stage, just behind the band, when they played. So I was like an extra member of the band, and it was a fantastic feeling.
Were you very conscious of the fact that there were guards watching to make sure none of the prisoners got up and tried to do anything?
All the doors were guarded, you know, and so there was quite a lot of staff. But it was a very friendly atmosphere, really, because, I mean, everybody wanted to see Johnny perform, including the guards.
One of those guards was Bertel Dahlin. Now retired, he returned to Österåker specially to meet us.
Here sat there ungefär 100 fångar.
Bertel told me that there were about 100 prisoners in the room and 20 guards when Johnny came out on stage.
Och där uppe kom Johnny Cash.
In that moment, he says he almost forgot that he was a guard.
I den stunden glömde nog lite grann att man var vakt.
Osteroper, you've been living hell to me. You've galled at me since 1963.
Bertel and Klaas never met on the day, but as we stood in the hall where Cash and his band had performed, they reminisced.
Jag skulle haft en liten confessing now that he really regrets not smuggling a camera in on of his own. Nobody would have checked him, so he could have done it. Jag var ju betrodd att komma hit. Jag fick stå där innan. Jag skulle haft en liten.
It sounds like that day really lives on in your memory as a very, very special day.
Yeah. Det är speciellt, det är speciellt.
I'll never forget. Halfway through the concert, Cash played a song written by none other than Glenn Shirley, who, as part of Johnny's touring roadshow, was on his way to becoming a country star in his own right.
I'm very sorry Glenn Shirley could not be with us. The parole board would not allow him to travel outside the United States for some reason. I don't know the reason. Glenn Shirley has been out of prison now for a year and a half, which is the longest time in his entire life that he's ever been out of prison. Here's Glenn's song about looking back in anger. A cold, bitter mist covers your eyes.
If Glenn Shirley had made it to Sweden, he'd have been shocked by how different Österåker was to the brutal prisons he'd seen in the States. But I was intrigued to know if Österåker was proof of what Cash and Shirley had told the US Senate, that if you treat prisoners humanely, they'll be less likely to reoffend.
We've come to Rågsved, an estate outside Stockholm known locally as Drogsved or Drugsved. There's a former inmate of Österåker living here who was actually at the Johnny Cash gig. Apparently he's still living on the fringes of society, so maybe Österåker didn't work for him after all.
Det är den här
svingen
som går runt
centrum. Ja. So this is senior boende, which is like old people's accommodation.
Vad bodde du förut?
Sitting listening to the concert with former inmate Ole Kongas, it was clear it had a big impact on him and his fellow prisoners. But what about the prison itself?
It was good food. I work in the kitchen, so I make my own food if I like.
Were you allowed to see your wife or girlfriend? Could she come in?
Yeah. You get rooms. So every visit have a room with a bed and sheets.
Sheets?
Yes, paper sheets. You only use one time.
Do you regret having spent so much of your life in jail?
Yes. I've tried to change my criminal, but I'm not good at nothing. Every time jail.
So you're 69 now and you're still going back to jail. That means prison hasn't worked.
No, they didn't work.
I asked prison therapist Karl-Oke Farbring if Österåker's liberal approach had gone too far.
Do you think that they possibly had too many rights here?
No, not too many rights, but they had conjugal visits in Sweden, which was unusual in Europe at that time. But the girlfriends brought drugs into the prison, and that was not good. The doctors were prescribing enormous amounts of medicine. So sometimes when they didn't get what they wanted, they were swallowing knives. So it was a blackmail on our psychiatrist. If you don't give me drugs, I will do that again. This was a chaotic time.
And was there evidence that Swedish approach, that Swedish philosophy, was having results?
No, we didn't have any evidence about that particular human philosophy that the relapse was going down. Absolutely not, no.
Well, if he stands tall enough to overlook another's fault.
If the Swedish system was failing to reform prisoners, back in America, as the 70s drew on, Cash's own personal rehabilitation project also ran into crisis. Glenn Shirley was struggling with the pressures of stardom, and past problems had come back to haunt him. Glenn's daughter, Rhonda Shirley.
He got overcome with responsibility, and he couldn't handle that. Trying to live up to other people's expectations. When he felt like that wasn't happening fast enough, or it wasn't happening good enough, or It wasn't what other people wanted. I think he started back on drugs.
Forgive another selfish deed.
And I think that's where it started to go wrong. I think that's where John and his relationship got strained, because at the time, you know, John has been known to have his relationship with drugs and with addiction. And at that time, John was doing everything possible to stay away from it. And Dad fell into it.
Eventually, he left his family in Nashville. And when he reappeared years later, he was a changed man.
He's gotta be understanding.
Glenn's stepson, Rusty Courtney.
He showed up unexpectedly at the door one day. His hair was down past his shoulder, big old long white beard. I didn't recognize him. I didn't have a clue who he was. I just know he was one scary looking thing. Skin and bones, in some old beat-up car, and I remember there was a blanket in the back seat just covered with blood. No idea what that was about. I remember Mom cut his hair, shaved him, cleaned him up, got back in the car, left. Didn't see him again, you know.
He quit performing. He quit writing. He quit all the things that kept him on an even keel. He always said that he'd never go back to prison. He didn't. So, and I think that's eventually why he committed suicide. Other inmates weren't going to say, you can't succeed. Look at Glenn Shirley. He didn't make it. I think that was his way of not going back to prison. He didn't want to be that failure.
So you felt that he would rather die than let people down?
Absolutely.
Hello, John. How you doing, man? I'm sorry that I can't be there today to be a part of your life.
Glenn Shirley took his own life in 1978. 10 years earlier, speaking from prison before his release,
I know that you've been a great inspiration to a lot of people.
He sent this message to Johnny for the TV show This Is Your Life.
Because I can honestly and truthfully say that you were the major turning point in my life. And maybe someday soon now, I can justify that faith and encouragement that you've given me by making a success and a productive life out of mine. God bless you, man, and I hope the kindness you show people is repaid to you, comes back tenfold. I love you.
Tommy Cash.
He took it really hard and didn't talk to anybody for a couple of days.
Glenn had been a project for Johnny in a way, hadn't he?
Yes, he had. I think Johnny was so devastated over Glenn's death that he just sort of pulled away.
Shirley's suicide was also a turning point for Cash, the prison reformer. Biographer Michael Streiskopf.
It's the death of Glenn Shirley and the failure for Shirley to be rehabilitated that I think in part takes some of the fire out of Cash's passion for prison reform. Cash was beginning to realize that there just was not the political will in this country to think intelligently and thoughtfully about how we treated prisoners.
There's a lot of strange men in cell block 10, but the strangest of them all was a friend of mine who spent his time staring at the wall, staring at the wall.
By the 1980s, Johnny's prison days were all but over. Glenn Shirley's death and his frustrations at the lack of any real reform had taken their toll.
Climb that wall, but I'm gonna be the first.
After 1983, he would never perform in a prison again. The questions he raised, though, about the effectiveness of the system are still as relevant today.
For there is no doubt they'll carry you out if you ever touch that wall. If you ever touch that wall.
Bobby Roberts worked for many years on the Board for Prisons and the future president, Bill Clinton, in Johnny's home state of Arkansas.
How significant do you think Cash was as a prison reformer?
What he said is correct. When I worked for Governor Clinton, I dealt with the prisons, and it was sort of like all the dark side of government. Nobody really cared about it. And I used to tell him, I said, well, you know, we can run the best prison system in the world, and you wouldn't get 5 votes for it. So nobody really knows what's going on. It's out of sight, out of mind. I think once it's publicized and once people see what's going on, you have people like Johnny Cash that call attention to it, then you begin to have to deal with it. And I think he was part of a movement that was beginning to take place in the 60s where people were recognizing that we can't keep doing what we're doing and that we've got to find a better way to deal with this. And you have a well-known person like Cash who stands up and says that. It makes a difference.
I'm Danny Robbins. Johnny Cash and the Forgotten Prison Blues was produced by Joe Wheeler. Johnny Cash! It's a unique production for the BBC World Service.
So that was part two of a series on Johnny Cash and prison. On the TMI archive page, you can find a link on last week's playlist to part one. You're listening to WFMU, Freeform Radio. My name is Benjamin Walker. We're about halfway through tonight's Freeform Podcast Hour. Man, the BBC archive is kind of amazing, and they have a few podcast feeds where they throw almost all of their long form documentaries in there. Highly recommended that one. We're listening to something from the Free Music Archive, Kid Caustic's Foxtrot. I'm going to let this one play out, and then we're going to hear an episode from Fran Panetta's podcast called The Hackney Podcast. She was one of our guests at this year's Radio Vision Festival last October. And Francesca is a pretty amazing audio producer, mostly interested in the experimental side. And you can hear that making its way into all of her work, including her Hackney Podcast, which is about the neighborhood she lives in London. We'll be right back.
The man walks and he speaks, and every word warps in the wind in the street. See an old man and woman with hands in big pockets and heads crouched on shoulders like parrots. Turn and see sky, pink as a dog rose, a can in a brown bag lying on black grass. See pylons and wires on sunset like skeletons of cinder.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. But there's no sickness, toil, nor danger.
A man walks and he speaks.
A man walks
and every word
and he
warps
speaks
in the wind in the street.
And every word warps in the wind in the street. Pass a sign. Read. Open. 24 hours.
Read.
Nursing. See pink fish scales and smell fish.
Fresh water fish.
See woman in chairs having haircuts.
Smell sweet fat. See a woman in a crumpled shirt move. See four cars swing.
Car, 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 car.
See
a girl with a brown monkey held in her arms. Read, invest in Hackney.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. But there's no sickness, toil, nor danger in that fair land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over
outside Albion Drive, right opposite the school near Queensbridge Road, where I live in Hackney. And I come out round about this time every morning to walk a short circuit, kind of crank the gears slowly into motion, and I work about 10 yards from where I sleep, but by undertaking this walk I seem to have gone into the world briefly and realigned all my compass bearings, and everything feels just about right. It's just a scratch around a circuit of the mind which takes in all the different conditions locally of busy part of Hackney, then London Fields, then across Mare Street and Victoria Park and back along a canal. So I get to see wildlife, get to see how the plants are changing in gardens, get to see strange bits of human behaviour, get to see people scurrying off to work, and you know, just generally get a sense of the world.
We are at Palm 2, which is the closest shop to where I live, and it's sort of my centre of axis when it comes down to Hackney. All walks begin at my local shop.
Where are we now? We're outside London Fields station and just walking along by the arches, hearing a train move above us on the line. There's a man with his finger in his mouth in a car.
Thank you.
just past a man holding a teacup by the rim. Those small details which somehow hook you and hold you. I start with these observations, and I think as I walk beyond a certain point, the observations take their own form.
It's a constant source of inspiration. It's like walking through a garden. Look at that building, look at that. I mean, that is the most incredible building.
The house we're coming up to with cracked windows, the house of the owl man. This is a man who's filled his house with wild birds of prey, and came into the house as a squatter, sort of 15, 20 years ago, and has been living here. You can see the windows are broken, and it's a kind of strange, gothic-looking house.
See a golden cup in an
alcove. See a driver leaning on a steering wheel, all crouched in a man-sized cab at the front of a bus.
A door opens,
and a foil wrapper slides across paving. See a man lifting up a glass of beer from a square mat. He laughs.
He laughs.
Tight way.
Writer needs to be in touch with the world around them, you know. And whatever gets you there, you know, whatever buzzes your buttons, you know what I mean? I mean, for me, it is walking. It is this walk. This is part of me being in touch with my world.
Walking I see as my studio, in effect, the environment when I'm walking. Some artists have studios, some writers have desks. And I see my studio and desk as the walk and the notebook.
They're absolutely practices which can't be divided, the writing and the walking. I mean, you know, I don't think of them as separate things at all. Writing is just the accident of sitting at a desk and putting it out on a paper.
It's like a person, isn't it, an area? It's like the earth is one person, you know. The more you walk, the more all of its sort of lines, as it gets a little bit older and it creaks and its posture, you start to get to know it a bit more. It's like getting to know a person, yeah. Like getting to know a person.
Smell buttered crumpets about a mile up there. I don't know where it was coming from when I was looking. And it made me felt like we should be having afternoon tea.
Going down to Primark, and then after Primark I'm going to Tesco. I'm walking all around the shopping area now.
Leave your squirrels.
Right, you two, leave him.
Sorry about that, mate. Good girls, off you go, go on.
I'm always walking. As far as I can go. You think about so many different things.
Yes, plenty little thoughts come to me. Yes, plenty little thoughts. Yes.
It's that this vampire story around here about a girl whose dad is a vampire and he lives in the cemetery just down church.
She's quite flirtatious walking as well.
Grace, if you could ever bite of any apple, would it be Adam's apple?
Well, I just try and like take on characters sometimes. I've been pretending to be a Frenchman today. Even though I can't even speak French, I pretend that I can.
Not running, but I'm making sure that I walk fast so that my toe doesn't touch the floor. I walk fast. about 10 minutes, then I'll start jogging a bit.
Boys who've got a lot of confidence normally walk with their chest out. Right.
People have like, I don't know, like,
slant, like
their the own individual like walk.
I just walk confident, right, like, with my head
your
forward.
Own swagger. Yeah. Swagger walk.
Yeah.
I went barefoot for a year from the ages of 16 to 17. I wanted to shock people. I wanted to discover another sense of myself. You know, your feet are like a sixth sense. You have another contact with the world. You start to understand warmth of tarmac and pavement, and different kinds of concrete hold heat in different ways. And the foot is quite an amazing thing, you know, flexible, and you can walk on gravel and your foot will calibrate to all the hundreds of different levels of every single pebble. You know, it's quite an extraordinary experience to go through, and all anybody could say to me was, I bet you can't do that in the snow.
I'm running my stick along the railings. I'm listening to the sound.
A city is made up of practices. The city is a kind of living tissue of cells. The speech of our footsteps, the generative grammar of our walking. We generate the city through the itineraries that we choose to make and carve out through the city.
I mean, people trace a lot of this stuff back to the idea of the flaneur, late 19th century decadence, and it was taken up again in the kind of surrealist strolls. And then, of course, you had the Situationist International, or the letterists before them, Letterist International, interested in ideas of urbanism and how you might remake the environment, and the derive, or the drift, which is where you just walk around and see what you encounter. But the secret of the derive, or the drift, was that you got blind drunk, and then you could really let the unconscious solitations of the architecture draw you forward and find different quarters of the city. But I've been drinking coffee, which is kind of the opposite effect of alcohol.
The crowd is his element, as the air is that of the birds and the water of fishes. His passion and his profession have become one flesh with the crowd. For the perfect flaneur, for a passionate spectator, it is an immense joy to set up house in the heat of the multitude.
The sweet sound of Hackney.
You know, there's all sorts of things. I've even slept down here about 25, 26 years ago on the canal. You don't get a lot of sleep. See some nice rats if you're into rats.
Oh my god, just have a look at this. Just look through the window, it's warm and glowing, and there's a table laid for like five people.
See two small tub-shaped candles on a table, each flame floating above its wick.
Each wick threaded blackly, each like a single stop, together. See houses and trees in the dark amber light of a street light. Cross sunken space like a gorge with railway lines. Pass a man wearing a black tie under the light of a shop.
right now it feels like the sense of melting, like, you know, maybe walking is the act of melting, utterly being fluid within your environment.
You just, off you go, you drift, you become as if on a stream, either of energy or of memory, and that carries you right across London.
Get home. I'm just thinking, like, I really want to get home right now.
I know dark clouds will gather around. I know my way is hard and steep. Beautiful fields arise before me, where God redeems their vigils keep. I'm going back. My mother, she said she'd meet me when I come. So I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going over home.
It's getting quite dark now, and I'm walking with my daughter who's fallen asleep on my shoulder. It's cold, it's winter time. And as we're walking, the anxiety sets in to get her home in time, just to be safe in a warm place.
I'm just going over
some buildings into yuppie flats. So, yeah, I done my little route from Kingsland Basin back home to Bethnal Green when I lived here in the 80s. And now there's nothing here. It's a bit of a Mile End Park, a bit of a dead biz.
This is it. This is your unknown. This is your magic. Under a motorway, in a very J.G. Ballard sort of way, an encampment where there are people living. There are really strange graffiti marking the whole wall. What a bizarre place. Who would know this was here? This is like stumbling across some traveller's camp in the desert. And so here is the unknown. Here is the real Hackney, within inches of this howling traffic. Just another across the road from Victoria Park. Absolutely amazing.
Split the world into two kinds of people. The people who say, I bet you can't do that in the snow. And the people who walk barefoot. And I'm one of the ones who walks barefoot. I went out in the snow. Left virgin footprints in the snow, man. Walked around the housing estate. Night time, you know, with thousands of snowflakes floating through the sky. And in the morning, I put on my shoes.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and worldwide, WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Fudge!
Nardwuar! Nardwuar!
And you're listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview with, from Red Bank, New Jersey, Kevin Smith, director Kevin Smith on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, where I interview people, play music, and hopefully inspire you, the listener of WFMU, to perhaps maybe do your own radio show. It's amazing to get feedback. And actually, I got some that I want to share with you listeners of the Nardwuar Human Serviette Radio Show. A while back, if you check the WFMU archives, I did an interview with, from Minneapolis, Minnesota, rapper Brother Ali. Well, I was honored to find out last week he wrote a song about me. But not just like about me, about the interview I did that aired on WFMU. So right now, to precede my interview with Kevin Smith, here's Brother Ali with the song Nardwuar on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. I'm so honored, Brother Ali, on WFMU.
I was so turned up off the interview I did with Nardwuar. I took the records home that he gave me and made a beat out of it. Matter of fact, made a whole song. Check it out.
Who are you?
I'm Brother Ali, sir.
Brother Ali, welcome to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Thank you. I've been waiting all my life to hear you say that, man.
They say, baby, you're not a star. You're too underground and too avant-garde. Can't nobody tell you how hot you are when you're chilling with motherfucking Nardwuar. I've been around the world a couple times. TSA know my name and let me cut the line. I'm tired of the scanner. Could you please keep the back of your hand off my groin and my butt this time? My cell phone full of heroes, underground rappers, activists, and weirdos. Chuck D, Cornell West, Immortal Tech. I got Lupe's joint, but I ain't phoned them yet.
let me tell you what my game about. 10 years and my flame never faded out. And I ain't have to go the major route. I dropped 6 joints, they all sold the same amount. 07, I was Billboard 6'9. Same sales, but I'm 4'4 this time. So while the whole industry in a decline, I ain't have to ride, still sitting just fine.
Oh my god.
They say, baby, you're not a star. You're too underground and too avant-garde. Can't nobody tell you how hot you are when you're chilling with motherfuckers. Nardwar. I'm on tour again, hopping out the Sprinter van. I'm arriving early just to kick it with the fans. Hit the bay, see the Muslims and visit in. I got a lot of fam, that's my man 50 grand. Love the road, but I must admit I miss the fam. Hit the mini-app and just had to kiss the sand.
Back to Minneapolis.
Breakfast at Victor's and Brasa rotisserie, be the dinner plan. Australia, my toes all in the sand. SBF 50, man, albinos never get a tan. Hit the bedhead. Spin like a ceiling fan. I calm down off Nina Simone cinnamon. Got my lady with me trying to be a different man. The ice blue ocean water got her in a trance. About to get in that none of y'all business. I took a glance in the mirror and I did my dance. They say, baby, you're not a star. You're too underground and too avant-garde. Can't nobody tell you how hot you are when you're chilling with motherfuckers. Nardwar. Went from trashy to hashtag team classy. My most lucrative years, I was the least happy. Our first tour, me and BK were coming up. We had to sleep on the floor and split $100. Every audience we saw tried to front on us. Had to shut them all up and it was fun as. Nowadays, it's like shopping with the trendy team. I'm trying to find a happy medium, is what I mean.
Keep on rocking in the free world.
Voice all raspy. The big magazines no longer holler at me. Protests and arrests all in my rap sheet. Homeland security file is my Grammy.
Oh my god.
Beautiful women always been attracted to them. Off the fact the music matters to them. So when they lift their shirt over their ribs, it's not to show me they. They took a quote that I spit and got it tatted to.
That's an amazing fan.
They say, baby, you're not a star. You're too underground and too avant-garde. Can't nobody tell you how hot you are when you're chilling with motherfucking Nardwar.
This fella right here.
They say, baby, you're not a star. You're too underground and too avant-garde. Can't nobody tell you how hot you are when you're chilling with motherfucking Nardwar.
Brother Ali, have you bought your horse yet?
I haven't bought a horse.
Why should people care?
Oh, yeah.
Thanks much, Brother Ali. Keep on rocking in the free world and doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Doo-doo.
Hello, are you there, caller?
I'm here, Nardwar. How are you?
Good. Who are you?
I'm the original human serviette of the Americas. They call me Kevin Smith. I made Clerks once.
Kevin Smith, welcome to the Nardwar to Human Serviette radio show.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure. I've done the real live version with you in person. We've spoken out in Toronto during the festival many times, but the last time when I was there for Zach and Mary. So it's a pleasure to talk to you on air, man. But, I mean, it's weird because you and I both have shticks that really require the clothing. And well, radio doesn't translate on the clothing. Clothing doesn't translate on the radio, does it?
Well, hold on a second here, Kevin Smith. Actually, I've never talked to you before. I should have said, welcome back to the Nardwar to Human Survey radio show, because I've never actually talked to you in person. That could have been
Zach and Mary, you had a van, no?
No, that wasn't me. That was probably a Nardwar imposter. Because the
you're telling me that somebody was literally dressing up like Nardwar and pulling my leg? I used a different human serviette than the true?
That was not me. I have never done an interview with you in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I would have loved to do that because the last time I talked to you was 17 years ago on a Nardwar to Human Serviette radio show when you were on, when I had the guy from Drawing Flies on as well.
Malcolm Ingram, yeah, that's right. I think that was where we were first introduced.
Yeah, like I was interviewing Malcolm and he had you call in to my interview. That was 17 years ago. So I'm not quite sure where this other Nardwar imposter has popped up from.
What's really alarming about it, too, is I slept with that guy, man. That dude told me he could get things done for me in Canada. But little did I know I wasn't sleeping with the true Nardwar.
Well, ba-boom on that one. But, Kevin, back to Drawing Flies. If people don't know, Why was the guy from Drawing Flies Malcolm on the Nardwuar to Human Survey radio show 17 years ago? Well, I guess I want to talk to him about his movie, Drawing Flies. What can you tell the people about Drawing Flies and your connection to it? Like, how did this all come to, like, Drawing Flies?
Drawing Flies was this movie that we made back in, let me see, I want to say 96. It was after we had done Clerks and Mallrats, and I was able to pull together a little money from Miramax to do a couple small movies, independent films. These were about 40 grand a piece. So Malcolm was a guy that I'd met at the Toronto Film Festival when I was there with Clerks. We became friends. He took me to Joey Jeremiah, Pat Mastriano's Christmas party in Toronto one year. And so he was talking about this movie he was trying to do with his friend. I said, hey, man, I can finance that. I got this little deal with Miramax. So we financed Drawing Flies. He took it to the Vancouver International Film Festival, a couple other places. It came out a few years ago on Indie DVD, a company that has since gone belly up. So we're about to re-release it soon ourselves under a Smodcast Pictures Presents banner digitally. We're in the age of digital now, so, you know, everything that didn't have a home before potentially has a home because now you can get things out to people a lot easier. Back in the day, very time-consuming, very costly if you're going to try to get somebody to release your movie. Now you can do it pretty simply on your own. So you'll be seeing more of Drawing Flies digitally this year, 2013.
And I think I love Drawing Flies, too, because, you know, the Vancouver connection, Vancouver Film Fest and Vancouver Film School. And I was wondering, Kevin Smith, Vancouver Film School, which you finally got an honorary degree from after dropping out. I loved it for years. They promoted, like, Kevin Smith, Vancouver Film School, and you went there for 3 months, right? For three.
I did. I dropped out after 4 months. But Scott Mosier, my producer, he went there, as did Dave Klein, our DP. So they definitely, they brought us all together, and we definitely learned some things there. I remember back in the day, after our first, after Clerks got picked up, we saw that Vancouver Film School had mentioned, hey, the boys went here. And we were so young and such dorks and mavericks or what have you. Just had such an attitude. I remember calling up the school and being like, you can't claim me, man, because I dropped out of the school. Years later, I became less of an AH, and I was just like, oh, God, claim us, of course, because without you, we never would have met. It was a really cool school program. At the time, it was the only